This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Most Americans know the celebrated heroes and storied history of the Civil Rights Movement, but they are much less familiar with another historic struggle for personal freedom, the long fight for individual rights of our country's largest minority, those with disabilities. In his new book, Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights, Leonard Davis details how disability activists, in the wake of the Civil Rights Act and LBJ's Great Society, worked with key legislators and others in the federal bureaucracy to recast the concept of disability from one focused on rehabilitation to one couched in the language of civil rights. As we mark the 25th anniversary of the Act, we'll get a bird's eye view of the genesis of this landmark legislation, the challenges it faced with implementation, and the potential the ADA still holds for the future of all Americans with disabilities. Today on The Exchange, we're taking a look at the history of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Let's hear from you. Have you had any personal experience with the Americans for Disabilities Act? Do you agree with the idea that reasonable accommodations for those with disabilities is a civil right? What do you think are the biggest challenges facing the ADA in the future? Who do you think should be responsible for addressing those challenges? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me for the show this morning from Washington, D.C. is Leonard Davis. He is Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts in the Departments of Disability Studies and English at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And he's author of the new book, Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. Leonard Davis, thank you for joining us for The Exchange this morning.
I'm very happy to be here.
Before we get into the book, I heard from my producers this morning that you were invited to the White House yesterday. Can you share that experience with us?
Sure. It was a wonderful and amazing event. There were many, many people from the disability community, activists and policy people, political aides, and President Obama and Joe Biden were there, and President Obama gave a very, very long, actually, an interesting speech, and it was very moving. This is to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the ADA, and Senator Harkin was there, Senator Dole was there, Senator Weicker, a whole host of people. So it was quite an event, one that I'll remember for a long time.
Senator Harkin, Senator Weicker, kind of key players in this legislation. Senator Dole, can you say a little bit about kind of his role in this? He's an interesting role in this.
Yeah, I think Senator Dole was as many people know, he's disabled. He was injured during World War II, severely injured, and and he became a senator, and he also ran for president, I think a couple of times, actually. And he was a logical person when people began to think about trying to pass the ADA to go to. He was majority whip, and then he was minority leader during that period. And he provided a lot of behind-the-scenes encouragement, perhaps some arm-twisting, you might say. He's been a staunch supporter of disability rights and still is. And yeah. I think he's 90 now.
Yeah, he's certainly in his 90s. And you tell a story in the book of Senator Tom Harkin, kind of a unique way of introducing the legislation into the Senate.
Jog my memory here.
Did he do a sign language for his? Is that not Harkin?
That was Harkin, but it wasn't an introduction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I thought that was to introduce the bill.
Yeah, well, I think it actually was when the bill was finally ratified.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, he gave a speech in sign language in the Senate. I think it was the first time that any politician ever did that. His brother was profoundly deaf, and Harkin grew up in the family and learned sign language from his brother, and gave a rather beautiful speech. And if your listeners want to see it, it's on YouTube, and it's totally worth watching.
Yeah, that's great. I looked on the web at some of the events. It seems like this is a pretty big, substantial celebration of this act over the next few weeks.
If you're in Washington, or actually in any major city in the United States, there are ongoing celebrations, lectures. I'm giving a talk at the National Archive in Washington, D.C. next week. There's meetings. There's going to be a march. I know that the Smithsonian is doing a film series. There are things at the Kennedy Center. It's big. And there's been a lot of planning. One of the exciting things is that there's been a disability or Americans with Disability 25-year anniversary bus tour that's gone.
Wow.
From every major city and small town in the United States. It's taken a year for the bus to go across the country, and Tom Olin has been driving it and hosting the display inside.
Yeah, I would encourage our listeners to check that out. You can find a lot of information about it on the web. Before we talk about the book, I want to talk a little bit about your motivation for writing this. You have kind of sort of a very moving discussion early on in the book about why you decided to write this book. Could you share that with our listeners?
Sure. I mean, I was actually approached by the press, by Beacon Press, who's the publisher of Enabling Act, to write the book. But my family background is that my parents were both deaf and profoundly deaf, and I grew up speaking sign language and in my household along with my brother. And I was trying to say in the beginning of the book, because I think, 25 years is a long time, and the effect of the act has been rather profound, but invisible in a certain kind of way. So it's like the issue around curb cuts. I mean, nobody notices that on every corner there's a curb cut. But that took legislation. That took a lot of work to put a curb cut on every single corner of every single block in the United States. So we forget what life was like, before then. And my parents, I tried to describe what it was like to be deaf, back in the day. And
right.
So some of the things I talked about was something very simple, like if anyone wanted to visit us, they would have to send a postcard to my parents, who would then have to send a postcard back, saying, yes, we will be home on such and such a time, and then assume that the person would come at that time. And often we had a very kind of wonky, kind of jerry-rigged system where we lived in an apartment building in the Bronx, and someone would ring the bell downstairs to get in to the building, and a little Rube Goldberg box would sort of trigger a thing that would drop down and make an electrical connection that would make the lights blink. And that way my parents knew that someone was ringing the bell. But, I would say 50% of the time it didn't work. So they could make all those arrangements for someone to come and nothing would happen. The person would be standing downstairs and my parents would be kind of unaware. But also they couldn't go to synagogue. They were Jewish. They couldn't go to the synagogue because there was no interpretation. When they went to the doctor, there was no one to help. The hospitals, there were no interpreters. Television had no captioning. So one of my jobs as a kid was to tell my parents what was going on in TV shows, which was a little hard and annoying to do when the show was very exciting and my father would say, what's going on? What's going on? And I would have to tell him. I know some deaf kids, some hearing kids, would sit underneath the television set and face their parents and tell and do the dialogue. So those kind of things where ordinary life was extremely difficult for my parents, although within the deaf community, they were very happy and lived full and normal lives.
Yeah, it is true, as you mentioned, that it has been a while. It was interesting in reading the book, some of the challenges that people faced in the 60s and 70s, you don't really even think about anymore, like, being unable to go to school because the classes are taught on the second floor and there's no way to get upstairs, or not getting a job because you didn't fit in the space where the particular employee had to be stationed because your wheelchair wouldn't fit. Really quite remarkable. I mean, it seems like we have certainly come a long way in the last 25 years. 5 years. The title of your book, this idea of the hidden story. Now, you mentioned that there was a media and public blackout as the bill was being developed in Congress, but it seems to me that you're implying something a little more than that. Could you say a little bit about, you know, why you consider this to be a hidden story? I think there are different dimensions to it.
Yeah, I think one thing is, you know, with any famous historical events or movements, it gets reduced down to a fairly simple story, which is fine. I mean, we need mythologies to understand history. There may not have been the Paul Revere ride in exactly the way we know about it, or, you know, but those are good stories. And in the case of disability, the story kind of very simple about, you know, disability activism leads to, a political change. And the hidden part that I'm trying to show in the book is all of the behind-the-scenes arm-twisting, you know, deals being made, secret meetings being held that were necessary in order to draft what is the most wide-ranging and comprehensive Civil Rights Act of our time. It involved, you know, people think about the 1964 Civil Rights Act and they think, well, that's really a huge act. And it was huge in terms of impact and in terms of its significance and in terms of U.S. history of slavery and discrimination against people of color. But it was a smaller bill in the sense that it didn't have as many moving parts, it didn't cover as many parts of life. So the Americans with Disabilities Act covers, you know, transportation, employment, communication, telecommunication. It covers, you know, architectural structures, you know, access to so many different areas that, in fact, it had to go through, in order to pass, it had to go through 4 committees and 7 subcommittees, which I don't think any bill, as I understand it, has went through so many committees of Congress and the Senate. So all of those stories are kind of fascinating, and in addition to which, part of the hidden story is that I did discover, I think I'm the first person to report on what went on inside the White House and through memos and so on that I got, but also secret meetings that were held that nobody knew about until I kind of broke the story.
Right, and it seems like a number of the key players, whether they're senators or other policymakers, you know, within their families had this kind of hidden experience with disability that sort of the average person might not know about on first glance.
Yeah, that's really true. And actually, at the White House yesterday, Obama told us something which I didn't know, which is that Michelle Obama's father has MS and used crutches or canes for his whole life. And President Obama was saying that, you know, meeting him and knowing him really helped him understand the issue around disability.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a neat way to think about such a large piece of legislation. We need to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to get into some more of the details of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll take your calls, emails, etc. Stick with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing the history behind the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act. We invite you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. And joining me today from Washington, D.C. is Leonard Davis. He's Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts at the University of Illinois at Chicago and author of the new book, Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. And Leonard Davis, let's go to the phones. We have Tanya joining us from Bedford. Tanya, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, thank you. Touching on a point that you were making before the break, in the 90s when ADA first became law, I was an architectural project manager for a large national retail chain. And at that time, we really didn't know what to do with ADA because there's portions of ADA that looks like a building code, talks like a building code, but unless it's adapted by a jurisdiction, it's not a building code. But it is an important piece of civil rights legislation, and being a large national chain, if we didn't make some of these accommodations, we were opening ourselves up to civil lawsuits. But you would talk to building inspectors and ask them about ADA, and they would be like, well, yeah, we've read it, but we're not enforcing it. We haven't adapted it yet. And in the beginning years, it was really difficult dealing with it. And we had to make a lot of very huge, expensive changes, like just cash wraps alone were a nightmare. I mean, luckily now, just I don't think there's probably any place in the country that hasn't adopted ADA, but in the beginning, it was a scramble.
Yeah. Tanya, thanks for that call. Leonard, let's talk a little bit about this issue of cost, whether it's architecture or other types of accommodation being made.
Yeah, just to respond to Tanya for a second, it was confusing in the beginning, and because the law was passed in 1990, but the regulations did come out a year later, but the regulations were still being written even 4 or 5 years ago. So, and there was a learning curve for everybody, I think. But she's right that initially there was confusion, and there still is to some degree. But I think the point that she made at the end was that, yeah, now when new buildings are built, the codes are in, you know, people build them with people with disabilities in mind. So it's a huge change. I mean, we're just talking about the buses, you know, one of the big fights in the ADA was to get wheelchair lifts on buses. And the bus companies were screaming bloody murder that it would mean the end of their companies. It was so expensive to put it in. But now it's completely part of our landscape. We don't even think twice when we see a wheelchair lift on a bus. So the costs, it's expensive. I mean, I'm not going to say that the ADA didn't cost people money, but in the ADA itself, if you want to talk about small businesses, say, for example.
Sure, that seems to be one of the criticisms
of
small business.
You know, this was a bill that was negotiated very carefully between the left and the right, between the business community and the disability activists. So it's a compromise bill in a lot of ways. And by the way, it's an incredible piece of bipartisan legislation that we should all take a lesson from now. But so the wiggle room in there is two phrases. One is reasonable accommodation, and the other is undue hardship. So what that basically says is that if it's going to cause undue hardship to a business to make an accommodation, they don't have to do it. There's a lot of legal definition about what constitutes undue hardship, but it's a significant term. The other one is reasonable accommodation. So if accommodation is unreasonable and it would cause undue hardship, it doesn't have to be done. This isn't a draconian law. It's an impulse. It's a push in the right direction.
Tanya, thanks again for that call. Leonard, let's talk a little bit about kind of the origins of this idea that disability should be treated as a civil right rather than the sort of earlier focus on rehabilitation. I thought that was really an interesting concept. And I think you say at one point, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you seem to be saying that viewing disability as an identity like race was kind of the big changing moment. But I must say, I often hear people say they don't want to be defined by their disability. So on the one hand, it's kind of an identity, yet they don't. It's not really something you necessarily want to be known solely for. So how did that all play out? The sort of shift from charity and rehabilitation to civil rights and laws and legal action.
Yeah, in disability studies, and we talk about these three major models. And the models are the charity model, the medical model, and the social model. So the charity model was, and this is sort of goes historically, so maybe if you go back to the 18th century, even the 19th century, you see disability as something that's seen as a punishment by God or something that a religious community should support. And so the model is charity. You give charity to people with disabilities. You give, you know, alms to the beggar. The crippled beggar or something like that. That switches to a medical model in which disability becomes a medical problem in need of a cure. And then the social model is one that says essentially that disability is not a charity cause or a medical issue, that it's a social issue, a political issue, really, that has to do with accessibility and removing barriers. So the classic example of showing you how the social model works is to say that a person who's using a wheelchair, say, is not disabled per se. They only become disabled when the wheelchair hits the bottom of a flight of stairs. So if we can change the social environment, if we change the political and physical environment, we can help eliminate the issue around the rights of disabled people to have access to things. So I guess the question gets raised, is it a civil right, or how did that happen? And in the book, Enabling Acts, I talk about how this consciousness changed, starting with, obviously the rehabilitation of soldiers returning from World War II, but then the civil rights movement itself in the United States really triggered for so many people, for women and for gay and lesbian, transgender people, and also for people with disabilities, triggered the idea that their identities were being discriminated against and they had civil rights that were being violated. So that switch from the rehab aspect to the civil rights thing was sort of across the board in the U.S. And once you begin to think of civil rights, then civil rights, by the way, in the book I kind of mentioned this, those are rights that we have from just being citizens in our country. But the reason that various civil rights bills get passed is because those rights, which are in the Constitution, are not being applied across the board. So for people with disabilities, they didn't really have the right to have a job that's not in the Constitution, but the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness and the kinds of things that we think of as ordinary citizens' rights, they didn't have. Just to give you an example, back in the bad old days, if you were a wheelchair user, you only had one of two choices. You either lived at home with your family or you were in an institution. Because you couldn't do more if you wanted to get out of the house and go to work. You couldn't do more than go around the block because your block didn't have curb cuts. Because if you wanted to get to work, you couldn't drive, and you couldn't take the bus, and you couldn't take the subway, and you couldn't take the train. So you were literally confined. How could you have rights under those conditions? So we have to think, we've come to think of the full access to the United States is rich array of things that citizens can do as necessary features of life in America, and we needed the ADA to get that standardized across the country.
Yeah, I want to talk about the 1980s in a moment, but first I want to remind our listeners they can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us at exchange@nhpr.org. My guest today is Leonard Davis. He is author of the new book, Enabling Acts. It's all about the history of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And again, you can join our conversation. Leonard, I thought the 1980s was a really interesting period, basically reading about how all of the sort of all the key players kind of navigated the Reagan administration and the sort of the focus on deregulation and states' rights. And can you talk and it was a fairly conservative group of politicians and policymakers, yet the development of the act was able to move forward.
I'm sorry, I missed the last.
Yeah, but so despite the Reagan administration's focus on deregulation and states' rights, the act was able to move forward. That I'm interested in you talking a little bit about sort of how they navigated the Reagan administration.
Okay, actually, one of the motors that really started the ADA was a funny story in a way. There were a group of Berkeley hippies, who had started Independent Living Center in Berkeley. Berkeley was kind of the hotbed of disability activism. And they, they decided that they were going to come to Washington and try to stop the deregulation that was going on because it was affecting disability across the board. And so a bunch of people came and sort of crashed on the floor of a guy named Evan Kemp, who was a Ralph Nader raider, and his thing was disability, and he was disabled himself. And they came, and he gave them a little corner of his office, and they started trying to work on limiting the deregulation. Part of the interesting story was that this guy, Evan Kemp, was a really good bridge player, and he had a Thursday night bridge game, and the person who came to that bridge game was George Bush Senior's legal counsel, C. Boyden Gray, who's just about as conservative as you can get. He's one of the founders of the Federalist Society, okay. And this bridge game went on for years. And Boyden kind of learned from Evan about disability, and it was sort of a whimsical moment. So you've got these Berkeley hippies sleeping on Evan Kemp's floor, and you've got this connection to the White House and to the corridors of power. getting and understanding and becoming friends with Evan and understanding the issue about civil rights. So when George Bush Sr. became president, Boyden Gray became the White House counsel, and this weird kind of strange bedfellow situation happened where these people like Patricia Wright, who was one of the people who came from California, was able to have a direct phone line meeting anytime with Boyden Gray. And I think that actually helped the strange politics of this alliance. And interestingly, George Bush Sr. Himself had this huge connection with disability. He had a daughter who died at 4 years old of leukemia. His very beloved uncle had polio. His two sons with disabilities. One who had a colonoscopy, and the other with severe learning disabilities. And so he got it. And it was an interesting political moment for him, because when he was running for president, you know, he had this idea of kinder, gentler conservatism, and the disability issue was actually one that fit in perfectly with his goals.
Yeah, you mentioned a story in your book about, there was sort of a big moment in this process right around the time of the Challenger disaster, and they end up talking with George H.W. Bush instead of someone else, and he's very supportive even as vice president, and sort of foreshadows him being the one who signs it several years later.
Yeah, it was one of those like things that if you were in Washington, you'd be kicking yourself, because the National Council on Disability had come up with a prototype of what was going to become the ADA, and they were related to the executive office. So they had a big meeting with Reagan, and they were all excited to give him this report, and it was the Challenger disaster. Reagan wasn't there, but so they got the second best. They got George Bush, but it turned out it was perfect. It was more than kismet, because he got it. He didn't just do a sort of pro forma meeting. He really got into the details, and he remembered that when he became president.
Yeah, I mean, it ends up being an auspicious encounter. I want to mention Barbara emailed us, and Barbara used to teach diversity issues classes at a hospital where she worked, and one thing she noted was that the disabled minority is the only one that any of us can join at any moment. She's talking here about an auto accident, a slip, some other sort of tragedy, and your life changes. And she apparently saw that firsthand working in a hospital. So, Barbara, thank you for that comment. Leonard, absolutely. You can respond for sure.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, the subtitle of Enabling Acts talks about the fact that the people with disabilities are the largest minority in the United States. And that's true. There, anywhere between 15 and 20% of the entire population are people with disabilities. And I think we forget that because we don't think necessarily of people with disabilities as a minority. We think of, oh, there's a blind guy there, and there's a deaf woman over there, there's a wheelchair user. We don't understand that they make up a large portion of the population. They're the largest minority, and they're also the poorest minority, right. I might add as well. And I think the point about it is that people are afraid to think about disability too much because it's the one identity that you can get overnight.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to wake up tomorrow morning and be a black woman, but I could wake up tomorrow morning and be a person with a disability. And I think that scares people, so they'd rather not think about it
right.
than think about it.
Right. Well, thank you, Barbara. Leonard, let's talk a little bit about the courts. The book talks a lot about the sort of the ups and downs faced by the ADA. You mentioned Grove City, which I recall. And I also read somewhere that the 2008 amendments to the ADA were sort of a response to various Supreme Court decisions. I hesitate to ask you to kind of sum up where the courts are on this, but maybe you can give us a little insight into what you've seen.
Yeah, the thing was when the Americans with Disabilities Act passed in 1990, one of the areas that was somewhat problematic was the definition of what it meant to be disabled. So, you know, when you have a law, you have to have a protected class, and you have to define the protected class. So without getting into too many details, the definition of disability that was in the law was to some degree ambiguous, and the courts went to town with this, and they came up with like harebrained, crazy rulings. I'll just give you one, for example, which was that there was a woman who was HIV positive but didn't have AIDS. She went to her dentist, And she said, you know, feel my teeth. And on the form, she checked off that she was HIV positive. The dentist said, I'm not going to work on your teeth. So she sued. And the court, and under the definition in the ADA, you have to have an impairment in one or more life activities. Well, if you're HIV positive, you don't have an impairment in any life activity. So she had to claim, in order to bring the case, that her one activity that she couldn't engage in was unprotected sex. So the courts actually supported her, but they ruled. So the logic of the ruling was, you have to fill my teeth because I can't have unprotected sex.
That's interesting, to say the least.
So the Amendments Act basically got rid of the ambiguity on the definition and basically just used the word disabled.
Yeah. So where are we now in terms of the current Supreme Court? Have there been any recent decisions that give you additional insight?
I'm not a lawyer or a legal expert, but from my friends who are, I think that the case is still open. I think now there are better rulings. But it takes a while for things to work through. And I don't think the Supreme Court has actually ruled on anything post the Amendments Act.
Has this resulted, do you think, in kind of an uptick in litigation? I mean, sometimes we think about certain areas kind of being dealt with primarily kind of legislatively or politically, and others really become kind of the realm of the courts. Have you seen any evidence on that?
Well, I think one of the compromises that was made in making the ADA was probably the best thing would have been to have a bureau. That supervised issues around the ADA, but obviously the right wing did not want more a bigger government and so on. So so basically, the only way the ADA works is if people bring lawsuits.
Right.
That's the enforcement mechanism.
Right, through litigation. Well, we have to take one more quick break, but coming up, more on the Americans with Disabilities Act. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. As we near the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, we're discussing the surprising history behind this landmark civil rights legislation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email The Exchange at nhpr.org. And my guest today is Leonard Davis. He's Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts in the Departments of Disability Studies and English at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and author of the new book, Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. And Leonard is joining us from Washington, D.C. So, Leonard, we finally get to the Bush administration in your book, and we see New Hampshire's own former Governor John Sununu become an important part of the story. I think he's referred to as the bad cop in the ADA saga. Can you tell us a little bit about his role?
Yeah, he was White House Chief of Staff, and I believe he was brought in because Bush was perceived as not being forceful enough, necessarily, with a little bit of his patrician speech and values. And Sununu was supposed to be the bulldog. And I did interview him for the book, and it was interesting. But most people claim that he was against the ADA and that he put obstacles in place. And Boyden Gray, who was the White House counsel, was for it, and that there was a kind of split in the White House between the two of them, which I describe in the book. Mm-hmm. Sununu had a somewhat different take on it. You know, everybody's got their own point of view. He saw himself as just carrying the water for other people. But I do begin the book with a kind of interesting anecdote with Ted Kennedy screaming at John Sununu that people might want to read about.
Yeah, and you also talk about Sununu's, I think, barbershop problem, the idea of a barber on a second floor of a building and how that was going to affect his business.
Yeah, that was a point that he brought up, and others did too, about what happens to the small business if it seems to need a gigantic accommodation. And as I said, that was settled with the issue about undue hardship.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Leonard, Dan from Concord writes in, and he says, I'm curious to hear what Leonard Davis thinks are the most problematic loopholes in the ADA. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, just before I do that, though, you know, there is a whole line of thinking, and I think we're going to actually be hearing this during the presidential election this year. Rand Paul's already said something like half of the people on disability benefits are fraud.
Right.
So the issue of fraud and of drive-by lawyers is out there. And I think that that is very exaggerated. I've seen a number of studies that say that the fraud rate or the error rate for disability benefits is less than 1%. The drive-by lawyer thing is mainly happening in California, which is not because of the ADA, but because of California has a stricter law. But I think the main point on those issues is if places are not compliant, they should be. You know, I mean, so if lawyers are taking advantage of businesses that are not compliant, well, then businesses should make the effort to be compliant if they can afford to do so. So loopholes, I think that any law, any bill that's passed is going to have problems enforcement around the edges. Could ask the same question: what are the loopholes in Medicare? What are the loopholes in Medicaid? I think that probably one of the biggest problems, and I think this was built into the law, is that, and this is something that really needs to be changed. If you're getting disability benefits, you can lose them instantly if you get a job. So there's an irony there that, you know, that there are many people who would like to work. I mean, there's a 75% unemployment rate among people with disabilities, and many of those people want to work. But many of them have things like home assistants or people who get them up in the morning and get ready to go to work, or wheelchairs or, you know, power chairs, things that they would lose insurance on and lose coverage for if they went to work. So there's something that needs to be fixed in that regard.
Yeah, one of the criticisms I read was that, you know, the bill in the 80s and 1990 was kind of sold to conservatives by saying that it would be a way to increase employment opportunities for disabled individuals. And I guess they cite some data now that shows that, well, it hasn't really had a big impact on solving unemployment among disabled individuals. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it was definitely sold as a, in the moment of, you know, get people off the welfare rolls and back to work. That part totally did not work, and the reason it didn't was because there were no real incentives built into the bill. I mean, the one area it did work is in the federal government, where you could actually say, and Obama just mentioned this yesterday at the White House, that he had an executive order that asked for increases in the number of people working for the federal government, people with disabilities, and that has had a rather large effect. I think something like 12% of the workforce, something like that, in the government are people with disabilities. What you need is something stronger, something with more teeth. In Europe, the rate of unemployment for people with disabilities, and in Japan as well, is something like around 8%, as opposed to our 80% or 75%. And
wow,
the reason for that
difference
is because there are financial incentives built in. Companies are required to hire a certain percentage of their workforce as people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. So, excuse me. So you say in the book that the ADA probably wouldn't have passed the current Congress, and you just referenced Rand Paul. Let's talk a little bit more about where we are now, what you think the near future looks like, and maybe we could work in there kind of a discussion of that 2012 rejection of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. I remember that was the famous vote where Bob Dole made an appearance to kind of help sway things, and it still was rejected.
Yeah, I mean, almost all the politicians I spoke to, Steny Hoyer, Bob Dole, Tom Harkin, Orrin Hatch, people on the right and the left, say that this bill would never pass now. And if you think about it, it's a rather mild bill, and it's a rather important bill. So, I mean, we are in this incredible stalemate. And interestingly, the political moment at the time was the president was of one party and the House and Senate were of another.
Right.
So it was George Bush rather than Obama now. But there was an ability to pass bipartisan legislation, which I think all of us know now is extremely difficult. And the example you give of the UN treaty, I mean, there's a treaty that we have actually signed, and it's been signed by almost every country in the world and ratified, but we haven't ratified it. And the reason we haven't ratified it is because there is a paranoia on the right that any UN treaty that we sign means that we're giving up national sovereignty and that we mustn't do that. And in this particular case, they've been using homeschooling as an issue to say, like, we're not going to let the UN tell us how we teach our kids at home. But in fact, the law and all of its attachments make it very clear that that this will not affect any aspect of U.S. life.
So we're just not a part of, even though we signed that, we're technically not a part of the convention?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And it's been, they've refused to ratify it twice in 2 years.
Yeah. Are there any kind of key issues or directions identified by the sort of the activist community or the legal community regarding ADA? Kind of, you know, where do you see things? Are there any kind of hot button issues that are still out there, or is this pretty much just settled?
No. There are a lot of issues. I mean, one is, of course, the cutbacks in federal government, which directly affects people's ability to live independently. So there's a lot of concern and care that things not be rolled back. I mean, another issue which is important is that there is an old law on the books that allows what's called sheltered workshops. So sheltered workshops are, like, for example, Goodwill, as an example, has these workshops where people with disabilities, often people with cognitive disabilities, work for sometimes 23 cents an hour. And well below minimum wage. And while the regional executives of Goodwill make over $500,000 a year, so there is an effort, and I think Obama's administration is working on this, to we have a law, a bill coming up to end these sheltered workshops and say that if you're working for somebody, you have to get minimum wage. And that's actually a really important point.
Who are the key champions in Congress nowadays?
Well, Harkin was for sure.
Right, and he's retired. Right.
He's retired.
Ted Kennedy's no longer with us, right?
That's correct. There are people, I can't run their names off now, but obviously there are a lot of people who are supportive.
Sure. We have a little bit of time left. This is a little bit of an aside. I have to ask you about Jerry Lewis.
Okay.
I grew up with a muscular dystrophy telethon, like a lot of people. It was just, finally retired this year after 59 years. I even used to stay up late and watch Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet when Jerry would take a break. I never gave it much thought. I thought it was just kind of a way to raise money. But it takes a bit of a hit in the book. And I thought that was really interesting. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, Jerry Lewis within the disability community is definitely a bad guy, and it's hard.
Yeah, that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's hard for people to understand because he's a funny comedian, he's very charming, and he could do these telethons where he'd stay up all day and all night, and for this incredibly good cause. But the problem is the muscular dystrophy issue is just as an example. The money that is raised has never gone to any cure for muscular dystrophy. There is no cure. So there's a kind of an illusion that we're in the medical model with the cure.
Of solving the problem, so to speak, right?
Yeah, and it's also, one of the key phrases in disability community and disability activism is nothing about us without us. And the telethons are a good example of it being all about us, it was all about being people with disabilities, but they had no role. A lot of these organizations that we know of, the big organizations, are run by people without disabilities. And especially in the past, so the paternalism of it is something I think that was problematic. And Jerry Lewis himself, although well-meaning, and I think in the book I give some examples, had some, fairly crazy quotes about the pathos and horror of
He said at one point he held up a child and said, God made a mistake, we need to fix it.
Yeah, exactly.
Those sorts of things.
Exactly,
yeah.
And that doesn't play very well now. I mean, it's sort of like the way that, in the past, if you look at old movies about African-American, with African-Americans in it as domestics and so on,
right.
Seemed right at the time and nobody particularly complained. But when you look back, it's horrendous. And I think the same feeling is if you look at those telethons again now. And also, there's many of the people who were Jerry's kids are now, very active disability activists, and they really look back on those times as if it was a freak show that they were being brought out on stage to to display themselves.
Yeah, it really made me pause and kind of rethink the whole thing, because I just have such vivid memories of watching it as a child with my family.
Sure.
So we've got a few minutes left here. What's next for you? Do you have other projects in mind? Kind of what's your other than, you know, you have the book out now, obviously, but kind of what's next for you in this area?
That's interesting. You should ask. I'm asking myself the same question.
It's perfectly reasonable.
My main concern is I have a class coming up in the fall on disability and on the ADA, so I'll be teaching that. I edit a book called The Disability Studies Reader, and we're doing a fifth edition of that. For anyone who's interested in what disability studies might be, this is a pretty compendious book that's gone through now. It will be five editions, and That takes a bit of doing. We change the articles, probably a third of them each time, you get a window into. When I meet people and they say, "What do you do?" and I say disability studies, I get a blank look. If I said women and gender studies, or if I said African American studies, right, people would immediately understand. So disability studies is essentially the equivalent of women and gender studies or African American studies. It's the political, social, artistic, humanities, social science, whatever you want to call it, approach to the very complex issue of what is a disability, how does it manifest itself, how is it seen in society across the board.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me that you're in a department of disability studies, which I was not familiar with. Is that a fairly new concept, or are there other universities that have these kinds of departments?
More and more places are either having programs in disability studies or certificates. We actually give a PhD in disability studies. The department is probably about 15, 20 years old, so it's not that new.
Right.
And there are a few other ones in the country that do give PhDs or advanced degrees. But it's definitely a subject that's fascinating, and one that a lot of people are coming to, and is also influencing a lot of other academic studies.
Right. Now, I know the book is brand new, but have you heard anything from people in this world, or got any initial feedback or reaction? It's sort of, how are you doing with it?
It just came out, so we've got some nice pre-reviews from all the major, Kirkus and Library Journal. As far as feedback, some of the people I wrote about are happy, some are not happy.
What are you hearing in terms of criticism?
It's more personal stuff.
Oh, okay.
You know, I shouldn't have put in this piece of information about someone's love life or whatever.
Oh, I see. So yeah, the actual getting into the sort of the...
And then, you know, someone will say, like, well, you said I was sitting at a walnut table, but it was really an oak table.
Yeah.
So far, no one's really said, like, you got this totally wrong.
Right. Well, as someone who has written a book on economic policy, it's difficult to make the kind of, daily and weekly TikTok of the legislative process interesting, but I think you certainly managed to do that. There are a lot of, I encourage people, there are a lot of kind of interesting and colorful characters in this book, and it's a pretty surprising and exciting story.
I tried to make it a page-turner for something, you know, a kind of political Washington thriller, and so many people have said they found it to be this such.
Yeah, absolutely. We got just a couple, not even a minute left, but I want a real quick reaction. The issue of technology. I've been thinking about this and wondering if, you know, sort of incredible improvements in technology have really sort of had a normalizing effect on disability. Things that were barriers before just are not because of technological breakthroughs.
Right.
Is that something you think about?
I wish we had more than a minute. Just 2 points. One
yeah,
is
sure.
that, yeah, for like example, for deaf people, the internet, having iPhones and all of that has totally changed things. But the bigger area that is coming up is the accessibility of the internet. And, you know, now that we live most of our lives in the internet, we've made it so there are ramps and that there are curb cuts. But the internet is fairly inaccessible, and particularly websites for universities and businesses are not that accessible for blind people, for people with learning disabilities. And that is, there's a lot of lawsuits actually coming up around that issue.
Right, right. Well, as you can hear, we are unfortunately out of time. This has been an especially timely and important conversation, given that Sunday, I believe, is the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I'd like to thank my guest, Leonard Davis, for joining us this morning. Leonard, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. That's Leonard Davis, a distinguished professor of liberal arts in the Department of Disability Studies and English at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's the author of the new book, Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. And Leonard Davis joined us from Washington, D.C., following his visit to the White House to celebrate the act. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Noah Bunnell. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.